Good morning. This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Hope you had a great weekend. Things didn't go so well in Silicon Valley as Microsoft withdrew its bid to take over troubled Yahoo, and Yahoo's stock responded in kind today as shareholders hammered the company for the decision to turn down Microsoft's offer and to not take what was being offered by Microsoft. Microsoft backing away now, and so that's where we stand. Is there going to be any kind of a deal between Microsoft and Yahoo? Apparently, it will take some working if that's going to be revived. The biggest winner may well be Google. To talk with us about the latest developments is Ina Fried, reporter for CNETnews.com. Ina, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's talk about what happened with the talks falling apart. Was it simply over the offer that Microsoft was making?
You know, these two sides, for as much as it seemed like they were getting closer, remained pretty far apart. There was some optimism going into Saturday, but, you know, really they were still quite far apart. You know, more than $5 billion between the two of them, as well as just there was never really a meeting of the minds. You know, when deals come together, you know, the two sides grow closer to one another. They start to see the potential of working together. In this case, we really didn't see much of that. We saw, you know, Yahoo really reticent of joining forces with Microsoft. Particularly, you know, here we have the company founder, Jerry Yang, and the co-founder, David Filo, were the ones doing the in-person meeting on Saturday. And, you know, there just was still this reticence.
Well, and was it distinctly Yahoo's decision, or did Microsoft finally give up? Is it clear who said no to whom?
Well, I think Microsoft gave up. I mean, I think Yahoo had come back. Microsoft had offered $33. Yahoo had come back at $37, but kind of indicating that at $37 it was still kind of hostile to a deal, but it would probably do it. So it was Microsoft that made the decision to pull back. But you know, it was both companies that were pretty far apart.
And at this point, about half of the stock gain that Yahoo had made since Microsoft made the overshare, about half of it's now gone.
That's correct. I mean, a lot of the rise in Yahoo's price was, you know, the potential of this Microsoft offer on the table. And many of the other things that Yahoo has been talking about looking at, a deal with AOL or an ad outsourcing deal with Google, are not the kinds of things that would provide that immediate return to shareholders. They're not the kind of cash offer that we saw with Microsoft.
And what were some of the potential advantages of Microsoft and Yahoo joining forces? I mean, clearly they get a bigger share of the search market, but what beyond that, what were some of the strategies they potentially could have employed to get a bigger share of ad revenue?
Well, there were two big things that Microsoft was saying that they wanted. One was the engineering talent. You know, they see this as a years-long battle with Google, and basically Yahoo was the chance to bolster their army. And it was the biggest sort of other army out there. So it was two things. It was the engineering talent and it was the scale. I mean, when you look at where the scale in the industry is, you know, it's basically Google, Yahoo, and Microsoft. There's a few other people on that list. The social networks are really big, but have had a tough time producing a lot of revenue for all their size. So it was really that scale opportunity, as well as, you know, you had two huge brands, particularly in the U.S., in a lot of overseas markets, you had either Yahoo or Microsoft that was strong, so it would be a stronger global player because you'd be able to pick whichever of the brands was really strong in that country.
Do you expect that there's a lot of dancing around the Google corporate headquarters at this point, or do you figure that they think this could well revive itself later?
It's been all good for Google. I mean, you know, it's been a distraction to both Microsoft and Yahoo. They've both kind of pointed out each other's weaknesses. It's a little bit reminiscent of the ongoing election battle where, you know, Google's John McCain and you have Yahoo and Microsoft as Clinton and Obama duking it out. You know, you sort of can't lose if you're in Google's shoes.
Are there any other potential suitors for Yahoo, particularly since the stock price has now been hammered today?
Well, I mean, the companies that have been talked about, you know, AOL is out there as a potential merger partner, but AOL would be a much more traditional thing with, you know, Yahoo probably getting AOL's assets and Time Warner getting a stake in Yahoo. That's not the same as sort of somebody coming in and buying it. So for Yahoo shareholders, and I think this is why we see the stock dropping so much, there's not a sort of clear other suitor out there.
So there's no potential that Time Warner could outright buy Yahoo or make a bid to do so?
I mean, it's certainly possible, but I think if you talk to most Time Warner people, they regret buying AOL. I don't know that they'd be looking to repeat
double their
that.
Bet.
Yeah.
What about any other more conventional news organizations? As wondering, given its ownership of MySpace, whether News Corp under Rupert Murdoch might be interested.
It's a possibility. I mean, what we heard Murdoch say initially was, we're not going to get into a bidding war with Microsoft. Now that prospect is somewhat removed, although, Microsoft has sort of set a price now, and I think that price might well be higher than anything that News Corp would have considered.
Oh, that's if Jerry Yang, though, stays as the CEO, right? And is that a definite that he's going to continue to run the company?
Well, I think he's going to come under tremendous pressure. I mean, Yahoo has basically said, we're worth more, without sort of the clear sense on Wall Street of how that's going to happen. So I think there's going to be tremendous pressure on Jerry Yang, and I think that's why we'll see things like them turn to a partnership with Google in search advertising, assuming they can get antitrust approval, to try and demonstrate how they're worth more. But there's going to be tremendous pressure.
Well, is that going to be difficult to get regulatory approval, given that they are competitors on the search side?
I think it's certainly going to be challenging. I mean, you have the number one and the number two players joining forces, and the number one player with a pretty dominant share. In general, that can be a tough battle. I mean, the interesting thing here is in Microsoft and Google, you have two pretty strong competitors. And so whenever either of them talk about doing something big, the other sort of says, ooh, I don't know, that raises antitrust concerns. I think there's sort of a sense that, both companies are pretty strong.
We're speaking with reporter at CNetNews.com, Ina Fried, sharing with us what happened over the weekend when Jerry Yang, the CEO of Yahoo, flew up to Seattle, Washington for efforts to close a deal on Microsoft's acquisition of Yahoo. Things broke down, and the two companies, at least for now, are going their separate ways. There'd been a significant increase in the value of Yahoo stock since Microsoft announced its intent a few months ago, and now about half of what the benefit to Yahoo stock was is gone as a result of shareholders walking away today. If you have questions for Ina Fried, we're at 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. What kind of ripple effect, if any, do you anticipate in the market with other tech companies?
Well, I think, there's going to be sort of a scramble to do deals. I mean, I think Microsoft is likely to pursue someone else in the space. AOL in particular becomes, I think, the company that's certainly on the short list if you're looking to boost your business. It's not clear that AOL offers anywhere near the kinds of benefits strategically that Yahoo did, but, it is one of the big players out there. I think, there's a lot of Web 2.0 companies that are going to be finding themselves struggling in a market that's turning down and, will try and make themselves attractive to the dominant players, Microsoft and Google. And, potentially Yahoo, I mean, we might see them try and also, show that they are still a big player.
I understand that, digital advertising executives are not happy about the collapse of the deal because they're looking for ways to standardize the industry, how billing is conducted, how digital ads are placed, that sort of thing. And does this then delay that kind of standardization for the ad industry?
I think you're going to see a mix of sentiment on that. I mean, I think there are some people that think a stronger Microsoft would be better for the ad market. Others, haven't necessarily seen what they're looking for Microsoft. As far as standards, I think those will come, I think. You know, we always see that once an industry sort of settles itself. I mean, there didn't used to be standards on banner advertisements, for example. Every time you wanted to advertise on another site, you had to redesign your ad for that site. And, you know, as things settled out, we got more standard advertising sizes. I think we'll see similar things in new media in terms of video and so forth. But, you know, it has more to do with what stage of the technology phase we're in as to where standardization comes in.
Well, it's kind of odd that you would have people in the advertising industry who are supportive of a merger, which you would think at face value would cut down on competition that would mitigate ad rates. But some of them seem to feel that if you put Microsoft together with Yahoo, that actually makes things more competitive because then they're bigger relative to Google.
Right. I mean, in this industry, you have sort of a strong number one and a comparatively weak number two and three. Yahoo is stronger in what's known as display advertising, the sort of branded banner and other advertisements that you see. So they are stronger in that. One of the reasons it gets less attention is it's less profitable. Most of the money in internet advertising has been through search advertising.
All right. Anything to add, Ina Fried, before we let you go as we look at the fallout from the weekend decision on Microsoft and Yahoo?
No, I think it'll be interesting to just keep an eye out for really hearing from Microsoft and Yahoo, both of which have said they have a strong plan B. You know, I think everyone's going to be watching to see, you know, just how much of that was talk, and, you know, certainly keeping an eye out of, you know, do the market forces change enough to bring them back to each other.
All right. Ina Fried, thanks very much from CNetNews.com. We appreciate it. Reporter's been closely covering the story of Yahoo saying thanks, but no thanks to Microsoft. So the deal involving a proposed acquisition of Yahoo by Microsoft is dead. Coming up, we're going to turn our attention to the extension of negotiations between the Screen Actors Guild and Hollywood Studios. June 30th is when the contract between the parties is due to expire. The question is, will actors decide to take a job action to strike and shut down production in Hollywood, or can a deal be worked out? And standing on the sidelines right now, waiting a chance to get into the game is AFTRA, the smaller of the two performer unions in Hollywood. It's going to wait until at least Tuesday, as talks have been extended from last Friday now to Wednesday. We'll talk about why the extension and what are the outstanding issues to be negotiated. If you have a question about the negotiations, you can call us now at 866-893-KPCC, 866-893-KPCC. 5722. We'll update you on the latest developments and the most important of Hollywood's potential job actions. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC.
It's a Prairie Home Companion under the stars at the Greek Theater on June 6th. Garrison Keillor and the entire Prairie Home crew will be there, along with the world's greatest red-haired blues guitarist, Bonnie Raitt. Garrison Keillor and a Prairie Home Companion with Bonnie Raitt and Martin Sheen live at the Greek on Friday, June 6th. For tickets, go to kpcc.org.
Good morning. It's 10:19. This is 89.3 KPCC. I'm Mark Thomas, sitting in for Hedy Lynn Hurdies. Contribute to KPCC today, and you can help restore forests destroyed by wildfires. Give $10 a month, and we'll plant 10 trees to say thank you. The more you give, the more trees we can plant. It's just that simple. Your contribution can also honor a friend or family member, and we'll list their names on our website. Contribute online at kpcc.org. Help keep forests growing and public radio strong. Talks between SAG and Hollywood Studios set to resume later today, with just 3 days ago that the union backed off some of its demands. SAG contract expires on June 30th, both sides trying to avoid a repeat of the 100-day writer strike. You can hear more on that story coming up on Air Talk with Larry Mantle. Police want your help this morning. They're trying to find a missing 22-year-old woman who has the mental capacity of a 10-year-old. Erica Ebony Granderson was last seen about 9 o'clock Thursday morning at Queen Anne Park on West Boulevard in Mid-City, L.A., Her mother had left her while taking another one of her children to school. Granderson is a black woman, 5'10", weighs about 275 pounds. She was last seen wearing a black shirt, black pants, and white shoes. If you have any information, please call the police at 213-485-2582 or 213-485-5381. A quick look at traffic in South L.A. The 110 North is slow from Manchester to Adams. This is 89.3 KPCC. It's 1021.
This is Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. People in Hollywood holding their breaths, hoping that a strike can be averted and that production won't be shut down when the SAG and AFTRA contracts with Hollywood studios expire. Steve Gorman, entertainment reporter for Reuters, has been covering the talks to this point. Thank you, sir, for being with us.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, doing well. Well, the talks were scheduled to end on Friday, but we now have an extension until the middle of this week. What led to that willingness of both sides to extend?
Well, we don't know for sure, but people who are sort of close to talks have said that that SAG has made a couple of concessions that apparently was enough to convince the studios for their part to stay at the table and try to keep at it until they get an agreement. And one such concession was that the union is now seeking to what would effectively be a 15% increase in residual payments that actors earn from DVDs, rather than a doubling of the DVD residual rate, which SAG had been going to the talks demanding, and which was sort of seen by everybody as a real deal breaker, and it was something that the writers had who went on strike last year were also seeking and never got at all, and had to give up when the studios refused to budge on that issue.
Now, I don't recall, on back with the writers and directors, did they get any DVD concessions?
No, as far as I know, there was no. That was one of the big demands going into the talks on the part of the Writers Guild of America, and they ultimately gave that up in order to get a deal on another one of their big priorities, which was greater share of revenues from new media, the mm-hmm. internet and the like. And they did make some gains there, and so they sort of gave up the DVD thing for the for a better deal on the internet. SAG is hoping to improve on what the writers and directors got for internet residuals, but they also were insisting they wanted to get a better deal on DVD residuals. And they started off, as the writers did, demanding effectively a doubling of that payment.
I wonder how, some of the strong profits that Hollywood studios have been taking, even with the WGA strike, whether that might embolden the producers and studios to hold out longer, particularly since they have these contingency plans, they're looking to try and wrap up their productions by the time the contract expires. Might that embolden them to hold out longer?
Well, by all accounts, everybody in Hollywood is pretty much fatigued from this very tumultuous 100-day strike that the screenwriter staged, which ended just in February. And in fact, TV production is still trying to get back on its feet. And in fact, there's currently a sort of what they call a de facto strike situation in effect now with regard to the actors' talks. The actors' contract expires on June 30th, and that's a date that's now being treated as a strike deadline, in effect by the industry. Most of the studios have been pretty reluctant or unwilling to launch any new film productions since April or the end of March, early April, because they, in fear that they couldn't get them done, wrapped up in time before June 30th, when it's seen as, that's a possibility that there could be further labor unrest in Hollywood. So rather than be caught short, with a very expensive production sort of in process, if the actors were to walk out, studios are just waiting, kind of just sitting tight until these talks get done. So it's believed that the studios too have a greater incentive right now to kind of get a deal quickly and sort of get.
So they can get the shows back, going and movies
get film production back, get everything sort of back to normal and clear away all the lingering uncertainty.
We're speaking with Steve Gorman. He's with Reuters, entertainment reporter for the news service, looking at the talks which have been extended between the Screen Actors Guild, the larger of the two performing unions in Hollywood, 120,000 members of SAG, 44,000 of AFTRA's. The smaller unions members are co-members with SAG. So a lot of people whose work is at stake, involved in these negotiations for a new contract, and AFTRA is scheduled to take up negotiations at whatever time things break down with SAG. AFTRA said it will wait until Wednesday, when the next deadline for reaching a deal with SAG will have expired. Of course, they could always extend further if they seem to be making any kind of progress. We're at 866-893-KPCC if you'd like to weigh in. This obviously would have a huge effect on production in Hollywood if there is a strike, if they cannot reach a deal before the June 30th deadline hits. And as Steve Gorman was just saying, time of the essence if they want to get productions up and going so that they can fill the gap for the productions that are scheduled to end in the middle of this year. So there isn't that lag time. 866-893-KPCC. What's your sense, Steve Gorman, of how things are going interpersonally between the negotiators? You know, one of the problems that was there pretty early on with the writers' strike were that things seemed to get a little heated and personal early on in those negotiations. Then the producers brought in a couple of high-profile studio heads to try and bring things to a close. At this point, is there any sense of how things are working out personally?
Yeah, it's sort of hard to get a read on that because the two sides, unlike what was happening during the writer strike, have adhered very scrupulously, for the most part, to a media blackout. They're doing very little negotiating in the press. They're doing very little. There's not a lot of posturing and rancor, you know, public rancor, as there was during the course of negotiations between the studios and the writers, which everyone is sort of taking as a good sign, as a sign that the two sides are really sort of interested in just doing what it takes to get a deal, rather than making a lot of noise and saber rattling. So it's sort of hard to tell what the exact interpersonal dynamics are at the bargaining table. One would have to assume that they're making some progress and that they've now twice extended their self-imposed deadline. That the actors have made some concessions on some what had been considered major stumbling blocks going into the talks, and it's been fairly fairly quiet from the two camps as they go about their business.
Steve Gorman, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Steve Gorman joins us from Reuters, the news service, where he's entertainment reporter covering the negotiations between representatives of the Screen Actors Guild and of Hollywood Studios. This is Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC.
You can now get KPCC news delivered straight to your email box every day. Go to kpcc.org, click on newsletters, and sign up for KPCC's daily briefing. You'll get headlines, links to stories, and information on what's coming up on KPCC. It's all in new daily briefing. Subscribe online at kpcc.org.
Well, on Air Talk, we continue by going underground. That's right, underground radio in a whole different context. The sewer system of Los Angeles. Who would have thought that there'd be any interest in a book on this topic? But in fact, it's a fascinating new book which chronicles how Los Angeles ended up with a rather unique sewer system among America's major cities. The book is titled, humorously enough, Brown Acres, An Intimate History of the Los Angeles Sewers. It's published by Angel City Press. Anna Sklar, who's a veteran journalist, has done a remarkable amount of research into this book, which isn't only about the sewer system, but sort of the history of how Los Angeles has handled its human byproduct. Anna, great to have you with us on Air Talk.
Thank you, Larry. It's good to be here.
I appreciate it. Where did you get the idea for a book like this? Who would sit down? There's got to be a good book in the history of the sewers.
Well, originally, I have to admit that I first got the thought back in 1993 when a city engineer came up to me and said, next year is the 100th anniversary of the first sewer to the sea.
Let's throw a big party.
Yeah, exactly. And then I just kind of got interested in it, and I just couldn't let it go. I don't know why, but over the years I get involved in other projects. And then about 3 years ago, the L.A. City Historical Society came to me and said, you got to finish this book, Anna. And I finally got a grant from the John Randolph Haynes and Foundation, and I finished the book finally.
Well, and it is fascinating. We should talk about why Los Angeles is unique. What is it that's different about our system?
Well, several things. First of all, we're one of the few cities that has a separate storm drain and sewer system. Back east, even in San Francisco, it's a combined system. So whenever there's a rainfall, heavy rainfall, the sewers always overflow. In Los Angeles, back in 1887, the first city engineer realized that the sewer system had to be separate from the storm drains. And so, consequently, our storm drains are separate. That's one of the things that's unique. The other thing that's unique is the weird way that the system has grown over the years because of the political situation in Los Angeles. As fractured as it has been over the years, that's been the problems with the sewer system. It's kind of grown in the very strangest ways with pollution galore.
Well, and let's talk about where waste goes, first of all, because it doesn't all go to one location. People are who've been in Los Angeles for a while probably familiar with the Hyperion treatment plant right down on the coast near Dockweiler Beach, but it's only one of several different spots.
That's right. Actually, back in the early 70s, when they finally realized that they needed to build some additional plants, so now there are four treatment plants. Hyperion, which we call Big Daddy, treats about 350 million gallons
a day.
And
it's big.
It's very big. It's able to treat up to 700 million gallons during a storm.
Wow.
However, we have three other treatment plants. There's one at Terminal Island that treats for Wilmington and San Pedro. It's a fairly small treatment plant, treats about 16 million gallons a day, and it actually provides tertiary treatment that can be the water can be reclaimed.
Okay, I'd heard about Tillman in the Valley, but I didn't realize there was one on Terminal Island.
Yes, there is, and that was built way back in the 1930s, actually, was the first plant. Then we have the Los Angeles Glendale plant, which is right at the border of Glendale and Los Angeles, fairly close to Griffith Park, right across the river. It discharges into the LA River, and they treat about 20 million gallons a day from Glendale and some from Burbank as well. And then, of course, there's Donald C. Tillman with that beautiful Japanese garden adjacent, and they treat up to 80 million gallons
a day. That's in the Sepulveda Dam area, for those who aren't familiar with where Tillman is.
Yes, I was just out there yesterday, and it was a beautiful day, and the garden just attracts literally hundreds of visitors, as well, of course, having weddings at a sewer treatment plant.
Who would have thought? Yes, where are you? Yeah. For those who think it's odd to get married at a cemetery, as Forest Lawn is a popular destination, perhaps even stranger, it seems, to get married at a waste treatment plant.
Exactly. But oddly enough, the gardens are so beautiful, and the buildings that in which the bride and groom can have their guests received, you don't have any odors at all, and there's lots of wildlife flying in and over the lakes. So it's really quite a beautiful spot.
We're speaking with Anna Sklar about her new book of Los Angeles history, Brown Acres, an intimate history of the Los Angeles sewers. If you have questions about the L.A. sewer system, who doesn't? 866-893-KPCC. That's 866-893-5722. There's been such a controversy over waste treatment for reuse,
the so-called
toilet to tap, and Orange County has, you know, done a big program of reclamation for water. And of course, the idea is the technology can make the water so that there's no hygienic threat whatsoever once everything is treated. But there's still the idea of it that concerns people. And there are some who fear that trace amounts of some, you know, sort of waste product could also cause health problems.
That's true. I mean, there is that sort of yuck factor that people cannot get past. Unfortunately, the reality is that we're all currently drinking water that has passed through somebody else's waste treatment plant that doesn't necessarily get the kind of treatment that is available when you do reclaimed water. The sewage treatment plants in Los Angeles can be upgraded to provide this amazing clean water to the quality of distilled water, where if you really want to use it for drinking water, you have to add minerals back because
otherwise it has no taste.
It has no taste, and it doesn't have the nutrient value that you would want in water. essentially, the treatment literally goes through primary, secondary, tertiary, which is like microfiltration, reverse osmosis, UV light, and then it's sent through the sand layers to recharge the groundwater. Most of the water that we get, whether it's from the Colorado River or from Northern California, does contain discharges from upstream cities that cannot discharge to the ocean as we can.
Really? So even if you're getting water out of the California aqueduct?
Yes. Some of that water has come from Las Vegas. Some of it has come from Arizona. The cities upstream that discharge into the river, into the Colorado River.
Okay. So, yes. Yeah, so some of that MWD water that's making its way west is going to have treated water from urban sources.
That's right.
Very interesting. 866-893-KPCC to join us on Air Talk. Now, Los Angeles grew so fast,
yes,
and so big. I'm sure that had a lot to do with this political infighting that you're talking about. Because this is a massive project, a lot of money to be made on building different branches of the sewer system. So how did that play out in the halls of City Hall?
Not too well. Unless you were really a charismatic, dominating engineer, you pretty much had to bend to the will of the political forces. And both the residents of L.A. as well as the politicians really didn't want to spend money on sewer treatment. So as early as the 1915, 1916, 1917, there were bond measures. Nobody wanted to pay for any improvements. Sewage was running in the streets. People really didn't seem to care. Finally, in 1922, big storm. What they had was what was described as Old Faithful. They literally had geysers coming up in the streets from the manholes. And Hollywood contributed a movie, the film with an odor. And finally, the voters approved the first major sewer line, which now is the largest in the United States. 55 miles north outfall sewer, finished in 1925.
And that's the one that goes to Hyperion now?
It goes to Hyperion now. It also kind of branches off and does deliver some of its waste to Donald C. Tillman plant as well. However, that didn't solve the problems because they built a screening plant at Hyperion in 1925. And you had sewage continuing to flow into the ocean, a huge sewage field. What they did is they screened it.
Mm-hmm.
The wastewater just went directly into the ocean. The screenings were buried in the sand dunes. And eventually they were barged out to sea because there were so many screenings. And the people in Manhattan Beach, Hermosa Beach, Venice, and were so furious because the odors were just...
Must have been terrible because all this waste that's caught on the screens and then burying it is not going to do away with the odor.
No, and you had over 100 million gallons a day just pouring into the bay there.
We'll pick up the story from there. Anna Sklar with us on Air Talk, author of Brown Acres, An Intimate History of the Los Angeles Sewers. And it is a fascinating story. Los Angeles, one of the very few American major cities with completely discrete storm systems to take stormwater runoff separately from the sewer system effluent. Back with more after this.
Programming on 89.3 KPCC is supported by the Center Theater Group, presenting Spring Awakening, winner of 8 Tony Awards in 2007 for Best Score, Book, Choreography, and Musical of the Year. The New York Times said Broadway may never be the same. Spring Awakening coming in October to the Amundsen Theater. Priority season tickets available now at amundsentheater.org.
Good morning. It's 10:39. This is 89.3 KPCC. I'm Mark Thomas. And we've got a giveaway, a ticket giveaway, a pair of tickets to give away to see the exhibit Body Worlds 3 and the Story of the Heart, now through September 7th from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. It's at the California Science Center. The California premiere of Gunther von Hagen's Body Worlds 3 features over 200 authentic human specimens. Tickets are available at californiasciencecenter.org. And we're taking the third caller, the third person to call 626-585-7893. Jury deliberations resume today in downtown L.A. in the federal racketeering trial of former private eye to the Stars, Anthony Pelicano. He's charged with illegal wiretapping and running a criminal enterprise that unlawfully obtained information on the enemies of his high-powered clients. The jury has to decide whether Pelicano and his four co-defendants are guilty of the 78 criminal charges that they collectively face. Pelicano is charged with racketeering, which is a crime punishable by up to 20 years in federal prison. Quick look at traffic in Mid-City, L.A. The 10 West is sluggish from La Brea to the 405. In Costa Mesa, the 55 South before Baker, there's a crash in the right lane in Industry. The 60 West is slow from Fairway to Hacienda Boulevard. For the latest traffic and weather, visit our website at kpcc.org. This is 89.3 KPCC.
Anna Sklar with us on Air Talk. She's worked for a variety of different public entities in Los Angeles. She knows the city well, and she's been a journalist on public television and radio as well, and started doing a project for the city of L.A., the history of the sewer system. The whole thing morphed with the encouragement of the local history society, and the book Brown Acres, An Intimate History of the Los Angeles Sewers, has resulted. It's published by Angel City Press, and we welcome your call. Calls at 866-893-KPCC. So, Anna, you were just telling us about the biggest part of the route from the heart of Los Angeles to the ocean.
Actually, it starts in the San Fernando Valley. It's 55 miles long. It winds its way like a huge serpent, winding away along the L.A. River down to downtown and then making its way westward by gravity all the way to Playa del Rey, where it kind of empties itself.
All right. And how does Bayona Creek have a role in this?
It absolutely does. As early as 1887, when they designed the first integrated wastewater system, sewer system for the small pueblo of 26 square miles, many people wanted the sewage to go to Bayona Creek. And the city engineer said, no, this is not a good idea. It should go to the ocean. Subsequently, they did build a line to the ocean. But in the following years, Bayona Creek became the primary discharge point for overflows. So Bayona Creek was constantly being polluted. The health department was constantly badgering the city, you've got to clean up your act. You've got to stop discharging sewage. And, of course, the population just kept exploding so that the flow was just enormous. And, of course, many people probably still remember the 1980s when the city was violating not only its permits into the ocean, but was discharging sewage into Bayona Creek, discharging sewage into the ocean, overflows during the summer months, something that had really not happened before. And that brought about the ire of many of the environmentalists, and you had the organization of Heal the Bay. And finally, the city is no longer discharging any sewage overflows into Bayona Creek. But for years, they built special structures that allowed them to bypass the North Outfall Sewer and discharge directly into Bayona Creek to preserve the integrity of the sewer so that it didn't explode.
Wow. Now, because the city was growing so fast, what about neighboring cities? What have they historically done, those that are not part of Los Angeles?
Well, interestingly enough, in 1924, when the city first built the North Outfall Sewer and the first screening plant back at Hyperion, many cities that were adjacent decided to join L.A. and signed up to connect their sewers to the city. So right now there are 13 cities who are part of the L.A. city sewer system. Everybody from Burbank, San Fernando, of course, Beverly Hills, West Hollywood, of course, Santa Monica also is a major contributor to the sewer system.
That's no judgment on its citizens, certainly.
No. Well, originally Santa Monica tried to build its own sewer system, but the sewer outfall kept getting destroyed in the winter storm, so they finally decided to join up with the city of L.A.
And even Beverly Hills has waste product.
It does. Yes, despite
the real estate values there. That's right. Brown Acres, An Intimate History of the Los Angeles Sewers. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Joy in West Hollywood, welcome to Air Talk. You're on with Anna Sklar.
Hi, Larry.
Hi, Joy.
And Anna, I want to know, we're talking about dirty water. What about what about dirty politics? What's your favorite tale of dirty shenanigans as they pertain to the sewer system?
Well, I'd have to admit that my favorite story involves Lloyd Aldrich, who was the only city engineer who was able to get himself into the civil service position without taking an exam.
He's very talented.
Oh, yes. He was appointed by the only mayor who was recalled from office, Frank Shaw. Lloyd Aldrich managed to overcome everybody else's recommendations for what should be done with the sewers, and he insisted on doing it his way, which resulted in a plant that wasn't sufficient, that cost many millions of dollars, and had to be completely redone 2 years after it was completed. I think that the one of the interesting stories about Lloyd Aldrich is that he managed to get millions of dollars during the Great Depression for construction projects in L.A., and the federal government gave the city $7.5 million in 1935 to build a new sewage treatment plant. They never got it built. Somehow that money just kind of disappeared.
Studies, undoubtedly.
Many studies. Yes. There were many articles written about the plans for this great new plant, and just kind of never happened. So we know that a lot of that money went to some of the contractors who were very close to Lloyd Aldrich, who almost succeeded in becoming mayor of the city.
Joy, thanks. Thanks for your call. I mean, the amount of money we're talking about for a project like this, in today's dollars, if you were going to build a sewer system like this, it's hard to imagine.
Well, when they finally decided to go to full secondary in 1986, when they agreed to spend the money, the citizens did want now a full treatment plant. We spent close to $2.5 billion to upgrade the sewage treatment plant, which is a lot of money, and you can imagine what that would have been in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But in the past, I mean, there were many missteps. At one point, because we were supposed to get our sludge out of the ocean,
mm-hmm.
the city was trucking it to farms in other areas, but they decided to burn the sludge. Well, they spent a couple of $100 million to build a plant that never worked properly. So that abandoned ghostly buildings are still at Hyperion.
Was that because of the air quality issue? They couldn't figure out how to burn it without air pollution?
No. The problem was that the system that they used was really designed for a beer company, and the sewage is very abrasive. So what you would have is the sewage, as it was going through the drying process, would plug up the spark plugs. It would plug up every aspect of the drying process. And then gas engines that would burn, that would burn the gas. Those engines, unfortunately, were designed for jet airplanes. They couldn't run on sewage gas. So they had a couple of explosions. The plant just never operated properly, and they finally had to abandon it.
Your tax dollars at work.
Your tax dollars at work, exactly.
Right.
And eventually, they were planning to send our sludge to Guatemala.
Oh, I remember that. Yeah. Well, to tell us a little bit about that story. What led that to be called off?
Well, again, they were desperate to get the sludge out of the ocean. And a private company came to them with this plan. Well, for $60 million, we'll take your sludge and we'll ship it to Guatemala. Guatemalan ambassador to the United States says, terrific. City engineer and the city attorney and some other members of the Public Works Department flew to Guatemala. It was, as they said, the trip from hell, because they arrived and they were put on this ramshackle bus. It was just a year after the first democratically elected president. There have been decades of civil mm-hmm. war and unrest in the country. So they're driving down this unpaved road with turrets, standing in the turrets with machine guns aimed at them. This was not what the city engineers had expected to find. Plus, it was 100% humidity. There was no way that sludge could have then been recovered to be used for agriculture, as the Guatemalan government said it would be done.
Okay.
So eventually, the environmentalists got wind of it, and it got abandoned. Very short, they were ready to sign the contract, like hours before they were going to sign the contract. And the president of Guatemala said no.
So what about all the sludge on the ocean floor?
Ah, well, that's why you have brown acres. After they had begun discharging sludge into the ocean in 1956 with a 7-mile pipeline that went 350 feet into a cavern, it created the black hole of Calcutta. And once they stopped discharging sludge into the ocean, that area has now been amazingly restored very quickly, so that there's more marine life now. What happens to the sludge now is that it goes to a place, 4,700 acre farm called Green Acres, and they grow non-human food crops, mostly for dairy farms, and there's about 1,000 head of sheep who come down regularly to graze on the alfalfa. They grow wheat, corn, and milo.
All right. Anna Sklar, author of Brown Acres, An Intimate History of the Los Angeles Sewers. Gary in Pasadena, you're on Air Talk.
Hi. Quick question about abandoned or multiple pipes. Because you noticed you mentioned the city grew so fast. My grandfather had his lawn explode one day in the Hank Park area, and when the city came out to replace the pipes that apparently had broken, they found a rat's nest of pipes that they didn't have any documentation for. I was wondering, also getting back to what you were talking about as far as the growth of the contracting, were pipes just laid so they could show that they did some work, but they actually didn't go anywhere? And how big a problem is this in the history of the growth of the area? And I'll take my
okay, thanks, Gary.
Actually, you're right. A lot of the pipes that were built, particularly in the 20s, in the early 1920s, they just discharged the sewage into open ditches. Some of them did connect to the north outfall, but most of them discharged into ditches, and then they were abandoned. Some of those sewers, once they were sealed, it didn't cause a problem, but some of the earlier sewers were built with redwood staves. And there's an area around Hyde Park, particularly where the first central outfall sewer came out to the ocean, that had been built 6.5 miles with wood staves and iron bands. That was sealed off, but unfortunately, the earth began to sink. And many of the people who live in that area, their backyards just collapsed into the old sewer. And so they were recovering these old wooden staves in the 1970s from a sewer that had been built in 1894.
Well, his question also about sort of documentation.
There's no documentation.
Okay.
Yeah, unfortunately, the early sewer development, the only documentation you can find in the city archives relates to the sewers, the major sewer lines, the central outfall sewer, the original Dockweiler sewer that was built in 1894, central outfall sewer in 1907, and then, of course, the north outfall sewer. And then there are lots of additional sewers that have been built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and those are pretty well documented. But some of that early stuff that was built at the turn of the century, the 20th century, there's you really just kind of stumble upon some of those early lines.
You know, the early line, you have a photo in here of stuff just going into Santa Monica Bay,
yeah,
just pouring out of a pipe. It's, you know, now, and they're just sitting there, you know, watching it go out into the ocean. It's huge volume of waste product. I mean, there's no way today. We live in such a time of different sensibility.
Absolutely. You know, it's amazing. You talk about that pipe that went directly in the ocean, millions of gallons. What's amazing is that people continue to swim in the ocean, even though there were signs posted. Also, during the 1950s, the San Fernando Valley was really suffering from sewage overflows because, again, the population explosion. The health department posted signs all along the LA River, and the kids still played in the sewage.
Yeah, well, kids, yeah, they're not necessarily going to pay attention to signs.
The adults didn't either. You could see sometimes there were signs posted, and people would still be playing in the sand that was literally littered with sewage debris.
Boy, this is, I'm looking at this shot again, 1935, and it's just pouring out. Is that near Dockweiler?
That's right by Dockweiler.
That's what it looked like with the bluffs of Playa del Rey there.
Yeah, it's very close to Bayona Creek.
So, yeah, there it is. So, yeah, those are,
They had to, you know, the screening plant could not handle the millions of gallons coming in, so they would build another pipeline and just a pipe, not even a line, you know, and send it out to the ocean.
Let's see. With us next, Gretchen in Lincoln Heights. You're on Air Talk.
Hello, Larry.
Hi, Gretchen. Yes.
I am so excited to hear Ms. Schuyler. I work doing residential sewer inspections.
Oh, great.
And the sewer system to me is fascinating. And one thing I'm wondering if Ms. Schuyler has heard anything about, I just think it's a shame that we use brand new water to flush our toilets and to water our lawns. And I'm wondering if there's any kind of plans for maybe a third gray water system, maybe not toilet to tap, but toilet to watering your lawn.
Well, unfortunately, there isn't any plan for that because of the incredible expense that would be required to establish additional piping for gray water. You'd have to have a whole new system coming from people's homes to do gray water. I think probably 30 or 40 years ago that might have been possible. But really right now what would be helpful would be for the city of L.A. to follow the lead of Orange County. We have the possibility of reclaiming millions of gallons of wastewater. Right now we're discharging it into the ocean through the L.A. River or directly from Hyperion. That water can really be cleaned up and recharge, center recharge basins. That water can also clean up industrial polluted wells in various areas of the city. The aquifer has become polluted because of the growth of industry. And so reclaimed water can actually clean up the groundwater.
Well, and this may just become a necessity at some point.
Well, we're right now looking at a drought. I mean, clearly the water supply is dwindled. We're looking at restrictions in water coming from the Colorado River and coming from Northern California. It seems like a necessity for the citizens to begin to consider seriously to get over the fear of toilet to tap.
We're a little short on time. Shirley in Hollywood wanted to ask about rats in the sewer. They sort of go together. They're hand in hand, aren't they?
They kind of do. But, you know, the flow of the water is so rapid that the rats really don't – there aren't too many rats in the L.A. system. You will find more cockroaches around the manholes one day, particularly around the downtown area. But there aren't too many rats in the system, again, because the flow is so rapid.
So the manholes cover both – manholes are both over storm drain system and over sewer system. You'll find both?
You'll find both. And usually during you don't get it so much now, but in the earlier days, particularly in the 30s, 40s, 50s, and even the 60s, you would have manholes covers just popping out from the
– gas that would just
not
blow them off? Oh,
the sewage, too much sewage.
Oh, just you couldn't handle
the
okay.
The pressure. The pressure would blow up the manhole covers. In fact, in the 50s, they sent the engineers out in trucks and parked them over some of the ones that were the worst case to keep the manhole covers from popping off.
Whoa. We have someone off here wanted to ask about a study when Tom Bradley was mayor about the sewers needing billions of dollars in repairs. This goes about 25 years ago.
Yes, in 1985 is when really the problems of the sewers became immediate. And yes, that's when the citizens finally agreed to start. I think it was 86, they passed the first bill for $1.5 billion to improve the system. And even today, there are tremendous amounts of money being spent to improve the system. And that's because of, again, a lawsuit. The city has responded primarily to the pressure either of the environmentalists, such as Heal the Bay, which got organized because of the sewage spills. Recently, Santa Monica Baykeeper also. And, of course, the EPA. And just a few years ago, close to 10 years ago, they agreed to
Retrofit the sewer system?
Yes, to clean up the whole sewer system.
Anna Sklar, thank you for being with us. We appreciate it so much. Fascinating book, and I love these historic photos that are included in the book. Yeah, it really is a fun read. Great bathroom reading. Brown Acres, An Intimate History of the Los Angeles Sewer. That'll make your guests laugh when they see that on the back of the toilet. Air Talk on KPCC.